So on the phone with me today from New Brunswick is Tracy Glynn from Jatam, a mining advocacy network based in Indonesia. She's speaking in two New Brunswick cities this week with two women from Indonesia to talk about Canadian mining company Inco and its operations in Indonesia and the need for Canada to regulate our mining, oil, and gas companies operating overseas. Welcome to the program, Tracy.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
Maybe you could first introduce yourself, explain who you are, what's your involvement with Jatam, and why you're on a speaking tour of New Brunswick right now.
So I've been involved. I went away to Indonesia in the year 2000 with CUSO, and I was working with an NGO that was supporting communities that were affected by mining, oil, and gas companies. And so there was one case in particular that was of interest to me because it was a Canadian company, and just the list of abuses that was occurring in this community and that have occurred over the last almost 40 years, it really struck a chord with me, and so I decided to work more so on that case, and I worked with Mining Watch Canada and several groups in Canada that were very supportive, and we ended up. And the company that was involved is Inco, and they're one of the largest nickel mining companies in the world, and they also have mines here in Canada and smelters and refineries in Sudbury and Port Colborne, Ontario, as well as they've just began mining in Voisey's Bay, Labrador. So we ended up, with help from Mining Watch Canada and groups here in Canada, setting up networks, too, here with people that are affected by Inco. And so that's been going on for the last few years, and we've organized things like bringing people from Inco-affected communities to Inco shareholders meetings in Toronto. And so in this case in Indonesia, there's one community in particular, the Kransi Dongi Indigenous community, that has been the most marginalized with the development there. And so finally, we were able to get somebody from that community to Canada. They were going to attend the Inco shareholders meeting back in April, but with this roundtable process that has been occurring, we decided that we would try to infiltrate that process as well as do a speaking tour throughout Atlantic Canada to spread awareness about what's going on in her community, as well as in other communities as well that are affected by Canadian mining and oil and gas companies. And it's especially important right now because the government is discussing regulating this industry. So there needs to be much more public awareness about it, so that there's much more public pressure on our politicians to do this, to regulate companies.
Tell me a bit about Inco's environmental and human rights track record.
Yeah, it's pretty horrible. In Indonesia, they've been operating for almost 40 years now. So they signed a contract with one of the world's most brutal dictators, with Suharto, back in 1968. It was the second contract ever signed with a foreign investor in Indonesia, and it provided numerous leeways for the company. It didn't involve the communities at all in the contract negotiations. Communities were not consulted, and they were forced with a very inadequate compensation, or if any compensation at all. And for people who did refuse the compensation, they were jailed. Community leaders were jailed. So as to make an example of what happens when you protest or when you criticize this operation. So they ended up opening up a smelter too in 1977, and that caused widespread air pollution too. Only 10 years ago did they start to install scrubbers. These cleaning technologies have been around for a long time. They've been, due to public pressure in Ontario with their smelters there, they installed scrubbers and filters to clean their air emissions. But in Indonesia, it's been only in the last 10 years that they've started, and they still haven't installed, their furnace stack still do not have the proper filters, even though they exist. But the company, Inco, says that they're too expensive, that they have to install them in stages over several years. And even though they're making record profits all their quarterly profits are record-breaking every time I get Inco's press releases. they're making new and as well as and they're expanding their production there. So that's also a concern. It's an area with high biodiversity and high. It also has numerous endemic species. So it's the natural condition of that area is so important. It has three lakes that are very special too. They're sort of Indonesia's Great Lakes. One of them is the seventh most deepest lake in the world, and it has fish that are found nowhere else in the world. And these lakes have also been affected by the mine and smelter runoff, and they've opened up protected forest areas in Indonesia too, where 47% of Inco's contract area is protected forest. And Indonesia law prohibits open pit mining in protected forests, so they're just going ahead with ignoring that law. And they've also been successful in intervening on that Forestry Act and making amendments to that so that they can mine in these protected areas that are very important that these areas be protected. And deforestation in Indonesia is at a very crucial time right now. If they don't halt it, then it's going to be an ecological disaster, and it already is. And so those are some of the problems in Indonesia, as well as in Guatemala. They've been linked to the murders of activists. The UN Truth Commission report in 1999 documented specific cases where people who were critical at the time of the Inco project there were gunned down in Guatemala City, as well as in the area, in the Lake Isabel area where they were mining. And there was also a protest where people were shot at, and I think there was 100 indigenous Mayans were killed at that, and the gunmen were seen leaving in Inco trucks. And so and none of this has ever been, Inco has never been held to account for any of these abuses, and so I think this is why this process is very, Canadian companies do need to be regulated because in many of the countries that they are operating, they don't have the legal mechanisms to ensure that human rights abuses and environmental crimes do not occur. And then also you see the case with Inco too is also intervening on laws to weaken them. And they're doing the same thing in Canada too, but I think we all need to be working together. And I think this is what's really important right now. We have people coming from all different places in the world that are affected by Canadian companies to testify at these roundtables. So I hope that it does have an effect, and that there is some regulatory mechanism put in place just to make sure that these abuses do not continue.
What is the current regulatory regime governing Inco's operations overseas?
Well, right now they have like a contract. Like in the case of Indonesia, they have a contract with the Indonesian government, and they're supposed to be, and in that contract, they are supposed to be following Indonesian law as it changes with time. So what they've done in the case with the protected forest, the Forestry Act, Indonesia's Forestry Act, was only made in 1999. That law prohibited open pit mining in protected forests. So Inco said that their contract was made in 1968, and that since the contract was made before the law came to be, that they said that was unfair, and then they threatened Indonesia with international arbitration. And in most cases, international arbitration does not favor, or most in most cases, the companies are successful in those and not the countries. So they have been successful in weakening and deregulating laws to suit them. So even though there are legal mechanisms that they should be abiding by in these countries, they're also not following that too.
What is the role of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in Indonesian foreign investment?
Indonesia's one example of how the World Bank and IMF have totally screwed that country, where they've gone in there and they've intervened on Indonesian law to and made it more foreign investor friendly, things like making Indonesia's laws more conducive for foreign investors to operate, and that includes things like royalties. Like right now, in the case of Guatemala, I'm not sure what the royalties are in Indonesia, but the companies there. And the World Bank has also been involved in Guatemala with doing this. The royalties that the companies are paying is only 1%. So what they're taking out of Guatemala, the government there is only getting back 1%. And they've just, with saying that they're going in there to alleviate poverty and to the schemes that they've been using have only been to rich and multinational corporations and not to alleviate poverty. It's only, if anything, it's caused more poverty in these countries, more militarization, and more environmental abuses, too.
We know that Canadian tax dollars subsidize mining work overseas in several ways, from Export Development Canada support for projects to Canadian pension plan investments to tax breaks. What do you think the Canadian people can do to hold Canadian companies accountable for their actions overseas?
I think some of the things we have to do is we need to make sure that our Minister of International Trade, David Emerson, who's responsible for Export Development Canada, that we send them letters and that we tell them that we know where our money's going, and we don't support that. And in the case with the Export Development funded INCO's hydroelectric dam in Indonesia, I think $60 million of our money was used to build this dam that provided INCO with cheap electricity, not electricity to the communities, but to their operations. And this dam flooded people's homes, the mosque. It cut off the migration of eels, which was a main source of food for the community, a source of protein. And so I think a lot of Canadians aren't aware that their money is being used in this way, and that we really need to be demanding of our government and to making sure that this stop, and that they stop funding projects that are environmentally and socially responsible and destructive.
You mentioned that there's going to be a series of government roundtables that are making their way across Canada, specifically to address the issue of overseas mining operations. What do you hope will be the outcome of these talks?
I hope that they, at the end of the last roundtable is in Montreal, and that's next week. And after this roundtable, there will be some reports that has recommendations, and I do hope that the recommendations are strong. That they, before this roundtable process even began, there was a Senate Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Trade that recommended that there be a regulatory mechanism that was binding for Canadian mining companies operating overseas, but that was rejected by the Martin government at the time, and then they said that they would do these roundtables. So I think you have people that feel that that the process too has not been fair. They've already occurred in Toronto and Calgary and Vancouver, and they've been closed off to the media, as well as it's not been very public, where good process where more people can give input into it. It's very restricted. There's only been certain sessions where a certain number of people can present. So I think a lot of people that are involved, even they don't feel that it's a process too that they should be participating in, but it's still one opportunity to have the ear of the government and in order to call for these regulations. I think the roundtables, I think if anything, the side events that are going on around these roundtables are probably more important, because I think that is where people are coming together from all around the world that are affected by Canadian companies, as well as right here in Canada, and supporters here in Canada. And they're strategizing, and they're just learning more, and the Canadian public's becoming more aware, because there's been media generated around this. So, and this is going to create more pressure that's going to hopefully lead to regulations.
Great. Thanks a lot for your time, Tracy. Do you have any final thoughts or comments you'd like to share with our listeners today?
That it's really important, I think, that we do send letters to the government. I know and that we do get out there. We screen some films. There's a lot of good films out there about Canadian companies. The Curse of Copper, it's about a Canadian company in Ecuador. And there's environmentalists in Ecuador that are currently being intimidated. One person, Carlos Zorrilla, is currently in hiding because of his criticisms to a Canadian copper company there. So I think there's various actions that we all can take. We can form solidarity groups. Maybe we have a connection to a certain company, or a certain country, and we could form solidarity groups. There's active ones with Guatemala and Colombia here in Atlantic Canada, like the Atlantic Regional Solidarity Network, the Breaking Silence Network. These are all groups that we can get involved with. I guess just to say, too, there's Mining Watch Canada has great information, so it's miningwatch.ca that people can go to for more information, and the halifaxinitiative.org is a great website, too, to find out more about the roundtables.
Great. Thanks a lot, Tracy. See, you and the two women from Indonesia will be speaking tonight, November 9th, at the university in Sackville, Mount Allison University?
Tonight we did Sackville yesterday, but today we're speaking at St. Thomas University at 1 o'clock at Edmund Casey Hall, and again at 7:30 at the Conservator House, 180 St. John Street in Fredericton.
Great. Thanks a lot, Tracy.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Tracy Glynn from JATAM, that's JATAM.org, a mining advocacy network based in Indonesia. For the CKDU News Collective Program, I'm Candace Moores.